You make a mistake, you get walked into a room by your best friend, you don't walk out again.
When you have revenge in your heart, you might as well dig two graves, one for you, one for them.
Takes you on a tailspin of terrible life. We all have past, but you can do something to present and future.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Millennials Choice Show. I'm your host, Matthew Ablican, and today I'm with my brother from the same mother, my co-host, Danny Ablican. What's going on, Danny?
What's going on, man?
We are shooting some awesome content again today in the studio, and we have a very special guest. But before I introduce him, you know I got to do this, guys. We keep the show free, but we want to make sure that we're getting as much love and support as possible. We want to bring you guys awesome content. Make sure you guys like and subscribe if you're watching this on YouTube. Share the episode if you're listening to it on any one of our podcast platforms. And I want to introduce a very special guest. It's not a real estate episode today, but we've got some awesome content for you. And I want to welcome to our show for the first time ever, Anthony Arelada. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Hey, what's up, guys? Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. And, we were just talking about how we had one of our mutual acquaintances, John Elite, on the show a couple of weeks ago, and that went really, really well. But we want to learn about you. We want to learn about Anthony. Danny has some awesome questions. I got some awesome questions. And I know our audience wants to hear from you. So why don't you just take us from the very beginning? Why don't you tell us who you were as a kid, your upbringing, your parents, and we'll start from there. Why don't we start right at the beginning?
Well, I was born in Springfield, Mass. From my mother and father, Italian. They weren't immigrants, but they were Italian, from Italian families from Italy. I was born and raised in Springfield. It was a heavily populated Italian city, a lot of immigrants from a couple of small towns of Italy, Naples, and a lot of immigrants from Calabria, Italy. And so it was heavily populated with Italians. And with that was a lot of organized crime presence in the city and the surrounding cities. So I grew up, hardworking. Father owned a produce, fruit and produce, wine, grapes, Italian specialty store. Grew up there and grew up working with, with him, family business. And, grew up going to Italian schools, hanging out in the Italian sections of the city, getting in trouble at a young age, and just being like a wild kid, not taken to school too much, just didn't like school, playing sports and getting in trouble on the streets, then it just gradually went as I got older. The small trouble became a little bit more, money-making trouble and violence, and just gradually led that direction. And, a lot with that came prison sentences and, the mob noticing you, the mafia, and hooking up with them and just going forward and getting involved in the mafia, becoming a made guy, and violence, money, murders, everything. So that's where it started. It started in Springfield and where I was born.
So I heard in one of your interviews that your family, basically your father had this store, which was like the Costco before Costco ever existed. It kind of reminds me of Danny and I's upbringing, where we'd go to wholesalers, and when my parents came to the country, they opened up a convenience store and they had some goods and services that they would sell out of that store. So we'd go to these wholesalers and they'd stock up and things like that, but it was never really too big. It was like 400 square feet. It was tiny. Did you ever want to kind of take up the family business?
So he had, his store was, one part of it was 32,000 square feet. And it was when I say it was like a, he used to put, you know, this is going back to the 70s now. And he would bring, you know, how the a pallet of potatoes, let's say 10 pound bags of potatoes. He would just bring the whole pallet and leave it on the pallet on the floor for the customers just to take. He would do that with multiple pallets, onions, potatoes, apples, and he would have sections of where people could pick stuff, but he would also just leave everything on pallets. So when they came, they could just take, instead of taking maybe, you know, 10 apples, they could take a box, you know, a 20 pound box. And so, yeah, that was his, and, you know, he catered to the low income families, mostly immigrants. A lot of them back then was, you know, the poor people of the city would go there, because if you went to a regular grocery store, for example, and you bought bananas, at the store, they'd be, you know, 99 cents a pound. Over there, he would have them 5 pounds for a dollar. So, you know, you would almost get like a third, or, you know, 70% off of by going to his store. And that's why he had a lot of, the store was packed. I mean, it was chaos there. The lines were out the door. He had 7 to 8 checkout tellers that were, you know, would cash people out. And there would still be a line of 20, 30 waiting to get cashed out. And he had, like, you know, probably the biggest small business in the surrounding area, the city and the surrounding towns. You know, when I say small business, meaning like, you know, not corporation or anything like that. And he was big into the wine grape. He was the biggest wine grape distributor in Massachusetts and Connecticut, in this around the surrounding areas. And it was a hard work, though. So getting back with me, I worked there at a young age, you know, since I've been a little kid, 6 years old, I was going to the store with him. And, you know, he had me counting money, straightening out, putting all the 20s and 50s and, by, you know, putting them in order and counting them in $1,000 packages, or $2,000, you know, with a band around them. And so that got me around money at an early age. You know, so he got me involved in that part. And that's the part I liked. The other part, it's a lot of work. You know, you're picking up 40 pound, 50 pound boxes of lettuce, putting them, you know, he sold 7 trailer loads a week of produce.
That's a lot.
People, you know, that's like, there was like 28 pallets on a trailer, and he sold like 7. And then he would run out and buy stuff locally from the local markets. I mean, he had a huge business. It was a lot of work. It was a family-run business. We had all of our, you know, both sides, grandparents on both sides, aunts, uncles, cousins. There had to be like 15 of us working on a given day. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun there. The store growing up there was a lot of fun. We had, you know, every Sunday we would have, it was like an office in the back. His friends, my friends, you know, as I got older, organized crime guys would come in, and, you know, it was just like we'd have a feast in the back room, drinking homemade wine, having, you know, cutting up Italian meats and cheeses. And every Sunday we would do that. So it was a lot of fun there. But it was a lot of work, nothing that I wanted to get involved in. I mean, he offered me to get more involved later on. I didn't want nothing to do with it. I always wanted to, I wanted to go the next level with that business. Sort of like a Costco, bigger, and have everything there, like a Walmart, something like, you know, where they, you know, cause he sold the produce. He sold, you know, Italian meats and you know, sauce and tomatoes and olive oil and things like that. But, you know, he could have sold everything there. He could have sold every single thing that you go into a grocery store to get. He just didn't have the space for it. So that was the level that I was pushing. And you know, it was just it never got to that level. You know, it's a family business. He had a family to take care of, my mother and sisters and stuff. And And I just started hustling on the street, making a lot of money on the street. And that's when I, didn't have anything to do with it. Chose my own path.
Right. And so I wonder, is it because, like, what made you want to get into the street life initially? Was it you saw the hard work, the manual labor that you saw your father kind of, you know, raising you in and what he was going through and the family was going through? Or was it something else? Like, what made you really want to go to the street life initially?
So I was always fascinated with the mob type stuff as a young kid. But that still didn't lead me to get into the mob or anything like that. Growing up, we were violent kids. So that automatically puts you on notice with the grown up, the elderly mobsters and the organized crime in the city. We were violent. We had a gang of us. We were always getting into fights. We were always hurting people. They were bad fights with weapons involved most of the time. So that is a big part of mob influence, what they look at. For me personally, what got me more into the streets, I had that mentality of, being a wild kid and getting in trouble. I went to prison at a young age. But what really got me into it at the end was it was common sense about money. Excuse me. I went to prison in 1990. I was 20. I think I just turned 21. I was 21. 22 maybe. And so I learned a lot when I went to state prison for that. I had to do a year. I was in there for a gun case and I got 5 years. I had to do a year. During that year, it kind of gave me, it was the best thing that happened to me. If I could go back, I would never change that year I had to do because of the learning experience that I got from guys that were, I had to go to a state prison and I was around a lot of older guys that were doing life in prison, never could get out. I was around guys that were involved in organized crime activities and really taught me ways of making money on the streets that I wasn't, that I really wasn't doing before I went to prison. And one in particular gentleman was Brian Goodman. I became close with him. And so what it came down to was common sense. The marijuana business was in the state of Massachusetts. If you got caught with under 50 pounds, it was a misdemeanor. You couldn't be charged with a felony if you weren't in a school zone. And back in the 90s, I don't know if you guys are aware, but there was a lot of crack cocaine, heroin. That's where the law enforcement was targeting those drug dealers. The marijuana, they never looked at guys pushing marijuana. So you had a chance to make money on the streets and not face any hard jail time, if any jail time at all. So what happened was I got out of prison in 91. I was working with my father at the store, and we were selling wine grapes. And these wine grapes, when you picked up these boxes, they weighed 40 pounds. You would stack them on a two-wheeler seven high. That's 280 pounds. You'd have to wheel them down a hill to get to somebody's car and load them up in their truck. And they probably would take 50, 60 of them at a time. And that went on all day long. And then the bees would come for the sugar of the grapes, and you'd get stung, and your hands would get all cut up from the boxes. Nails sometimes would go in you. I mean, it was brutal work. Your back is, you're breaking your back. And so I had and the money for me, it's a family business. I wasn't getting paid working for the family. I was getting, nothing for a pay because it's, a family business, and, one day it'll be yours type thing, So I left I had to go. I told my father I'll be back. I went. I sold 10 pounds of marijuana. I think I made 350 a pound. So I made 3,500. I was back within an hour. I left, sold them all to one guy. I made 3,500. I was back in an hour. And I was making maybe 400 at the time, working the whole week at the store. So when you put it like that, I just made in a, you know, one deal, $3,500, and compare it to the work I'm doing at the store and the risk reward of selling marijuana. You know, if I just stuck with marijuana my whole life, which I wish I did, you know, it would have been a lot different, you know, where I would be right now. The money that was involved was just out of this world. And the risk, there was no risk. I mean, there was no risk involved in the business. So that's what got me, you know, I was on the streets. I was selling cocaine also before that, before I went to prison, messing around with a little cocaine, selling it. You know, I did so many other businesses on the street, but the marijuana is the thing that got me on the streets, away from looking to do anything with my father's store, because there was so much money, and I answered to myself. I had no bosses in it. The organized crime criminals didn't have nothing to do with my marijuana business. So I mean, it was like the best of everything. You know, the mob didn't get involved in drugs. You couldn't go to jail selling the marijuana. Even if you got caught in the school zone, you know, with, you plead out to some probation charge or whatever. If worse comes to work, you might have to go for a little county, you know, 6 months or something. You'd be out right away and work release. I mean, it was no risk. And the money that was involved in you, you know, when it came down to it, you can make, forget it, you know, 100,000-200,000 a week if you really hustled.
Right. And, you know, I could see why that would be enticing to anybody, compared to like what you were mentioning, seeing what your father was going through, what you were going through, and other family members. Totally. And so I was listening in a Vlad TV interview where you said that you first encountered jail when you were 15 years old on assault charges. Is that right?
Yeah. My first arrest was for assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. And I was 15 and I was a juvenile. And I ended up getting found guilty at a trial. I got found to be a juvenile delinquent, but we appealed it right away. And on the appeal, witnesses came forward, different witnesses, and I ended up getting the, I don't know if I got probation for that or if it ended up getting dismissed. I don't remember. But I know if initially I got charged and got found guilty on it, and I was a juvenile delinquent, you know, considered. That's what they categorize you when you get in trouble as a juvenile. But there was no jail time or anything like that. And we appealed it. And the appeal, either I beat the appeal and won, or I got probation. I don't remember. I had so many cases, you know, growing up, so many assault cases, so many of them got thrown out because of connections that the mob had with the state U.S. attorney. So if we got in trouble, it had to be something really bad. And even then it would get, you know, you'd get probation for it. You'd have to really just keep pushing and pushing and pushing for you to get in any trouble or to be on the wrong side of the mob guys that you want to get any help from the state U.S. attorney.
Right. And you had a family friend of your father's who was also on the parole board for when you were starting to get, you know, into the serious offenses, right? So that's, you mentioned when you went to prison for 1 year, it was a 5-year sentence, but you only served the minimum 1 year, right?
Yeah, I ended up going to prison in 1990. And I got a 5-year sentence. So there was so many other cases that I got in trouble for assault and batteries. So I ended up eventually getting put on probation in 1989. Then 1990 comes and I pick up another case involving, you know, a gun. They said it was a shooting out of a car, the car that I was driving. It was on, you know, there was a lot of charges involved in it. And so that gave me the 5-year sentence that I received in 1990. And I believe that at that time, there was a lot of heat going on with the U.S. attorney that he was facing at that time. And also, I think Bruno was in, I don't know if Bruno was in trouble right then, because I know we both were in prison at the same time. But 1990, I received the 5 years, and I had to do a year mandatory because it was a gun charge. So I did the year, and that's when I was telling you I met a lot of, you know, not only that, you become you get responsibility in your life. You know, I was living at home. You know, if I'm living, you know, with my mother and father, I don't have no bills. I live here. I can eat when I want. There's no pressure on me. I can, you know, you get, you know, your family, you know, you don't have no responsibility. My mother will do my clothes if I wanted, you know.
Right.
And so when you go to prison at a young age, now you have to, you have to, you know, be a man in there, make sure no one disrespects you, carry yourself a certain way, take care of yourself, do your own food shopping, get your own clothes done. And so it kind of like disciplined and gave me responsibility. And then on top of that, I made a lot of, I networked a lot, and I made a lot of connections in there throughout the state of Mass, mostly Boston, South Boston, you know, the North End, Charlestown, going to Worcester, going out that way. So I made a lot of connections. So with that 5 year sentence, I got that year I had to do was a great thing that happened to me.
And so when did you first get introduced to the mafia? What was it, you know, from just being around those mob guys, you know, them coming into your father's store? Because you're part of the Genovese family. So how did that happen?
Well, I was always around the organized crime criminals. Any Italian that grew up in our era of time, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s, was born in the 60s. The mafia had a presence in all the big city, you know, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, our city, Connecticut, Hartford, all throughout Connecticut. So there was always a mob presence, a mafia presence, all the way up throughout the 90s in all those cities, especially our city. So you just grew up and you knew about the mob. You knew about the mafia. You knew who, what it was. You know, you seen the Godfather movies and you see things like that in your city. You knew who the organized crime guys are. So growing up, and then, you know, you have family members that are involved with them. And, you know, my uncle was the driver for the boss of our city. So you just know who they are. I got involved later on officially with them when I got out of prison in 1991. That's when Bruno came and wanted me to be with him officially. So when you say, like, when did I get involved? That's when I got involved officially, where I would be on a record and take orders from them. And it would have been Adolfo Bruno would have been the guy who came to me. It was a couple of guys, Anthony DeLevo and Al Bruno. But, you know, when you're a young kid and I went to prison, I had a gun case. I was a violent kid. I wasn't yet a big earner because I was still young. I was only 22. But I was sharp, you know? So, you know, when you put all that together, that's a big, you're a prospect. It's something that they look for. As a young guy, especially being Italian, the mob looks at all those characteristics. So I fit, and that's when I got put on record with the mob in 1991. I got out of prison in February of 91, and shortly after that, I was put on record with them, with the local branch of the Genovese family.
Gotcha.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, Anth, so once you were made official, did you ever once make a decision that you kind of regretted and was kind of like, shoot, like my life is at stake right now, or, you know, like I could possibly die for this or anything like that? Because I imagine you're probably always, like, correct me if I'm wrong, like looking over your shoulder, trying to make sure you don't maybe overstep or, you know, do something that you maybe shouldn't do. Has that ever happened to you?
Well, I look back, you know, growing up again, when you grow up in that era of this, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s, if you were anything that was an Italian, a wild Italian kid, and you were looking to be a criminal, The goal was to be a made member of the mafia. So, I mean, anybody would tell, there's guys today that are still looking to get their buttons and become made members of the mafia, even today. So that are from that era, you know, that were, you know, they're in their 50s, you know, late 40s. But so that was the pinnacle of where you would try to achieve to. I achieved that. So when I look back, if I could say right now, I don't have no regrets and nothing in my life. I'm good with my life right now. I went through a lot. I did a lot. And where I am right now, I'm good with it. But if I could go back and change anything, what I would have did was I would have never got directly involved with the mob like I did. I would have used it. I would have never became a made member, because with the made member became the violence of murders. You know, the other violence, if somebody bothers your family and you go out and do something, you know, you get a couple guys and you go hurt them, you know, however bad it is, that's different. But when you're going to kill and shoot people that you grew up with or guys that you don't know and look to kill them, so that's what brings a lot of heat. That's what brings a lot of life sentences where you never get out of prison. And also, you have to take orders and do those type of things. And if you don't, you're probably going to get killed. So I would say that the only thing I would say is I would, if I could go back before 2003, is just stay. See, I made too much money at a young age. That's the problem. You know, everyone's goal back then in the 90s was make $1 million. Well, I made it really easy. And so it's like I got complacent with that. And so I still hustled, but I just was a little bit, I wasn't as aggressive like I was prior to making that first million. So I still made millions and millions of dollars, but it was like that when you go out hustling hard and hit the streets, it's like nothing else matters. You're just grinding, you're going out, nothing matters. You got appointments, you're making sure, you know, you'll have appointments all day long. You'll work 24 hours straight if you have to. But once I made that money in the like 97, 98, it kind of like I lost my that really hardcore aggressiveness to hit the streets hard. So if I could go back, I would say I wouldn't get made into the mafia. I would have stuck, you know, stayed with strictly hustling the streets, you know, a little bit of loan sharking, a little bit of sports, but mostly the marijuana. And I would have started, and I did start doing that back, buying real estate. Only the real estate wasn't fast enough for me. So I got in and I didn't stay in there because, you know, it wasn't the high you got from making money in the streets. You know, there was days I made, you know, I made $470,000 score in one day, you know, and then you're going to compare that to, buying a piece of real estate and, you know, putting some time and work into it, having somebody work to grind it out, to pull back some money and equity back out of it and refinance it and then put tenants in. And, you know, to me, it wasn't worth it. I was just making too much money. So if I could go back, I would have stuck with the marijuana and just put all my money into real estate and in other investments, legitimate investments, you know, putting that money, getting it, you know, getting involved in the real estate. Cause you could put the money into that so easily. You know, you buy those houses where it needs 50,000 of work, you get these guys that you pay, that's where you get rid of the money. You know, you pay them cash, fix up the house, put the tenants in it, and then refinance it and take all clean money, and you don't pay taxes on that money. So, I mean, it was, I would have did that, and I would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars right now. If I did that, I would have saved myself a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff wanted to happen. A lot of people probably wanted to have been dead, and I would be worth a lot of, I'd be living very nice. I live nice now, but I would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
I think that's a Millennial's Choice show exclusive that Anthony Arelato would buy real estate. And I love that connection, but everything that you just mentioned is what we talk about to our clients, buying those properties, investing, and then the refinance and repeat with tenants. So that's fantastic. You know, when you were like affiliated, so to speak, with the Genovese family, when you officially became, you know, working with them, you know, Vincent the Chin Gigante was the boss at the time, the acting boss, right? Can you, there's not much information out there on him, but can you kind of tell us like what he was like as an acting boss at the time?
So I never met him personally. I was not close, but I was very friendly with his brother Mario. I used to go to the family's houses, all the restaurants, the Gigante's restaurants. But I never met directly. I never met the Chin. The older guys that were from my city, you know, I would hear stories about the Chin from them. With certain beefs came up with individuals from different families, and the Genovese family in my city would get involved. You know, who he liked, who he didn't like. Like, he didn't like this this one particular the boss of Connecticut, underboss of the Patriarca family at one point, Billy Grasso. And he didn't like him. I know Billy sent him a bottle of Louis the 13th cognac, some sort, you know, a couple of gifts down there, and the Chin sent it back to him. And so I know he didn't like him. I know he didn't care for a couple guys in my city. But other than that, I never met him. You know, I don't have much to say personally on meeting him other than the stuff that would be public that people, you know, would know.
Yeah, fair enough. And we had John Elite on, as I was mentioning, and I was watching something that you guys recently did together, kind of almost like a round table panel with a few other guys. You guys used to work together? Like, how did you come across John Elite?
So like in the early 90s, I sold a lot of marijuana, and I met so many guys that were involved in the mob that were involved in the marijuana business. And back then, you couldn't be involved in drugs if you were had anything to do with if you were on record with the mafia, organized crime. So, but I did that, so that, you know, I didn't care what would the circumstance, or, you know, what would end up happening if I got caught. I just didn't care. When I got put on record in 91, you know, I was selling the most marijuana, you know, at that time, and I was selling cocaine, and I was doing robbing drug dealers and doing all types of things when it came to drugs. And so throughout the Western Mass, going into Eastern Mass, Boston, Central Mass, into Connecticut and into New York, I was networking, and I was meeting a lot of individuals at that time. Johnny Alight name popped up with a crew that I was dealing with in Manhattan. And they were moving. See, in New York, they would buy the high end weed. New York had more money. New York had Wall Street. They would be sending that good hydroponics, the high end skunks that were worth, you know, $3,000 to $4,000. You know, I could buy it for $3,000 and sell it to New York for $4,000, and they would take as many. You could have 100. You could have 1,000 pounds. They'd buy it all from you, because they had the market for it down there. So I was selling a lot of marijuana to New York, the high levels, and they would get rid of all the anything underneath that, you know, low end skunk weed, you know, low end dirt, brown weed, anything from $200 to, you know, $1,500. So that was the relationship I had. That's how I met a lot of New York guys. I met a lot of captains. I met a lot of soldiers, all in different families, and all of it was off record with the mob. Like, the mob was even though we were all on record, some guys were made guys, some guys were captains, some guys were, I even met an underboss in one of the families. But this was all, you know, not, you know, what do you call it, okayed by the mob than what we were doing. I was just doing this all on my own networking. Like the guys that I reported to in my city knew nothing about that. In fact, when I used to meet guys afterwards, when I was getting real close with Bruno afterwards, and he was looking, and I was getting closer with the New York guys of the Genovese family, and I was meeting these guys that I've been doing business with throughout the years, and we acted like we were just meeting for the first time, but we've been to dinner dozens of times. I've sold them hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of drugs, mostly marijuana. But we would act like we just met for the first time because, you know, they're going to say, how do you guys know each other? How come I didn't know you guys knew each other? You know, what do you guys, and you know, we were involved in the drugs. That's why we did it like that.
That's crazy. Anth, I was just wondering what kind of cigar you got there.
Oh, this is Oliva.
Cohiba? Next time we do this again, we'll maybe do it in person. We'll all have some cigars together.
We'll all have some cigars. Yeah,
that'd be nice.
Definitely. Let's set that up.
100%. So, you know, did you ever bump into Michael Francis? Did you ever know him?
I never knew. You know, I knew of him, of course, but I never met him. I never had any dealings with him. I did have a dealing with his, not personally face-to-face dealing with his father, but a transaction, or you could say, or something happened with his father, an interaction, but not personally with his father, but nothing to do with his, with Michael directly, no.
So we've spoken to Michael, and a lot of people know the story about the, you know, the gas scam and scamming the government out of the taxes and all that. Was that really as popular and as famous as certain people make it seem during that time? Like, was it catching the attention of a lot of mafia guys at that time?
Well, I mean, I think what caught the attention of back then, you know, and I was still in my teen, you know, I was a teenager, but His what got him back then was they put him on the Forbes magazine as one of the richest mafia bosses. So that kind of gave him a notoriety, you know, once he got put on that list. But what was mostly talked about with him was him walking away from the mob. That was like, you know, what everybody would be talking about in the 80s, like, they figure he's going to get killed. You know, you just don't walk away from the mob. You know, he did. He wrote a book about it. So that was the thing that was talked about with him more or less than the gas scam. You know, the fact that he was able to walk away from the mob, which you don't do, especially in the 80s. That's not going to happen. But he did, and he wrote a book about it. He went to California, wherever. And, you know, he, that's the most of the story with him, is that part of the story, that was, he was able to do that back then.
Is there any chance we could get, you know, work on something in the future, perhaps with you and Francis and maybe Elite all together?
Yeah, I mean, I like the guy, Mike. I never met him, but he's, you know, talks intelligently, carries himself well. You know, classy dude. I like him. You know, I have no problem with that.
All right. Okay, I'm going to make a note for myself here to follow up. So, you know, there's so many people right now that are coming out talking about that past life. Not condoning it, not you know, talking about encouraging people to join that past life, but really just talking about the experience and sharing what they would do differently, what they would regret. For those people that are listening to this, who might be listening to this and they might be in that position where they're about to make a choice. It could change the course of their lives forever. You know, what would you say to that person right now?
So what I say is, I'm not like one of these guys that denounce the life of crime that I lived and, you know, go into the church and don't ever do anything wrong. And I'm not that, you know. If you look at the world and how these the corporate world is, there's a lot of corruption there. You know, if you look at people, how they the politicians, there's a lot of corruption there. People in power, there's a lot of corruption there. So there's corruption everywhere. The key is to not get caught, or not to, if you do, not to ruin your life over it, not to go to prison. So my thing to the young kids would be is, you know, you got a lot of gangs today. I want to join a gang. You could still have a couple of good friends, close guys around you. But the gang, you ain't going to gain nothing by joining the gang. It's for insecure kids, being part of something, being a group, you know, walking together and being tough. But at the end, there's nothing good that's going to come out of that. You know, you're going to get killed. You're going to kill. You're going to go to prison. And at the end, most of them are broke. 95% of them are broke or don't make a lot of money in that life. And as far as organized crime, that's pretty much dead. Anybody with a brain don't want nothing to do. You know, they started figuring that out in the early 2000s. If you had a brain, the last thing you want to do is get straightened out in the mob, which I got straightened out. So that goes to show you where my brain was, where my head. But, you know, you don't want to join any organization. Why would you want to join something? We got to take orders. And if you disobey an order, you're a dead man. You could lose your life. So, and you have to give up a piece of what you make, let's just say, to somebody, you know, a piece of your thing. But what I would say is, I would, you know, there's laws. They'll tell you whatever business that you want to be illegal, like say the marijuana business, right? You know, the crimes that we commit, they're not crimes that you'll go to hell for if you don't use violence. You know, sports gambling. They just legalized sports gambling in all the states. Massachusetts just put it in now. So you could go and bet the Super Bowl Sunday and you could legally do it, put your money up and you could bet that. That's not a, you know, that's what we used to do. We used to take bets. That's not unethical or a horrible crime to do. When you borrow money from the bank, gives you the money to buy your house. If you don't pay it, the bank will come and take your house away. Well, we put out money on the streets. We loan charge, you know, we charge a lot more money, but it's still not, you're not going to go to hell or it's not a bad crime. The bad things come is when people don't pay and you hurt them or use violence or you, extort them and do things like that. That's the bad thing in that life. And there's ways you don't have to do that. That's what I'm trying to say. You don't have to get, you know, put, you know, use violence as a, there's always a way out of that. And if you got yourself into the position where you had to use violence, it's your fault. You know, are you going to let a guy bet $1,000, $2,000 a game if he makes $500 a week working? You know, so it's your fault if you let him take a shot at you. Same thing as folks, you know, giving the money. Same thing about having a number business. You could put number. We had the number business. Joker, poker machine, slot machine. Same thing with that. So the crimes and the marijuana. You know, marijuana is just getting legalized everywhere right now. So how can I tell a kid not to go out and hustle and make millions of dollars? And at worst, he might get probation if he's got a clean record. You know, like if I was a young kid again today, I would be hitting the streets so hard, making so much money, millions and millions of dollars, and I would be putting it into real estate. And that's what I would be doing now. And if I got, and the crimes that I would be committing, you know, you call them crimes, but they're not, you know, the only crime it is that you're not paying your tax to the government. You know, and essentially you really are, because you're putting that money back out. Like when you go to a restaurant, then you're putting it back into real estate and you're giving people jobs and you're paying them to work. You're still putting that money into circulation. So if you're selling marijuana, a lot of people smoke marijuana. That's not a crime. And they buy it legally at the dispensary. That's not a crime. But if you sell it to him, so it's not a bad thing to do is what I'm saying. It's not like, you know, it's a horrible thing where, you know, God's going to look at you and say, you're that's a sin, you know. But if you sell it, why is it bad? Because you're breaking all. Why? Because you're not paying taxes on what you're selling. You're not giving the government their cut. So if you keep it under the your guidelines, like I said, under the 50 pounds, and it was me personally, I'm talking me, I would look at it and saying, you're telling me I can make all this money and not risk going to prison. And, you know, I can still have a job on the side. I could still work. I would still be working if I wasn't, you know, I wouldn't be a, you know, a bum. If that didn't occupy all my time, which, you know, usually it does, you know, I would still have a job on the side and I would be doing that. And I would be combining them and I'd be buying real estate. And if you start at a young age, you know, you buy a three family house for a young kid at 20, 22 years old, you know, you buy one the first year, get, you know, two the second year. Now you're up, you know, and then it's off to the races. So, you know, so I'm not trying to, you know, tell kids to get into crime. I'm just trying to say, like, you know, there's opportunities out there with low risk, and violence is the thing that, that hurts everybody. You never want to use violence. There's always a way out. They say, like, you know, when you have revenge in your heart, you might as well dig two graves, you know, one for you, one for them. I mean, there's no winning when it comes to the violence. Even if you hurt the guy that you want to hurt, there's repercussions. You know, he might come back at you, look to kill you, or you might go to prison for it. So the violence, I would say, for the kids is no gangs, no joining, no gangs, no organizations, no, and no violence. And just, you know, swallow your pride a little bit, your ego, and just hustle the streets and work and invest your money. I like real estate personally. That's what I would do.
Me too.
Shifting a little bit, because that's a very interesting take that you present, because a lot of guys, you know, on YouTube right now, some of them just, you know, they talk about their murders and they talk about this and they talk about that. And then and some of them talk about the complete 180 they did and all this stuff. So it's a different take. It's a different perspective that you're bringing to the table. But I do want to highlight that. I want to talk about that because I heard on one of your interviews about the first time that you did kill somebody. You know, that's something that we see on movies, we see in the news, we don't see in our everyday lives. But, you know, how did that one decision, how did that really impact you? Because you're talking about you would have went back and not become a made member of the mafia because it comes with that violence. And that's kind of maybe the initiation. So how did that one decision really impact you?
Well, the murder part, it didn't really bother me. I'm not trying to sound mean or cruel here, but in the streets we've grew up violently. How we didn't murder people when we were younger is just we got lucky. How we didn't get murdered is we got lucky. I mean, it was, you know, we grew up very violent, a gang of us, and so the murder didn't have anything to do with me psychologically, like what it did was it kind of like changed the whole way I looked at life. Once you murder somebody, that's when your whole life is different. When you're making money on the streets, even with organized crime, if there's no violence, you're not going to go to prison for a long time. I had three cases, 2003, I picked up a case, a racketeering case, 2005, I picked up a federal racketeering case, and they picked up another one in 2005, three racketeering cases, all pending all at the same time. I was held without bail after the third one, and they all involved sports gambling, loan sharking, numbers, joker pokers, extortions, but there was no violence. There was no somebody coming and saying, you know, we put that person in the hospital or we shot that person, or there was no violence. And they were all multi-million dollar businesses that supported a, not just me, but supported a crew of us. So I ended up receiving 3 to 3.5 years in the state prison. And I got 29 months in the feds running concurrent with that. So all I had to do was do the 3 to 3.5 and I was done. And that's involving, and they knew that I was a suspect in several murders and beatings and violence, but they just didn't have it under my indictments. But they knew that I was a suspect. They just couldn't put that in the indictments. And I only got 3 years in prison for making millions and millions of dollars of money. And I was the extreme high profile person that they were after. Now, everybody else that was underneath me, nobody went to prison. One guy got 3 years because he got caught with a gun. A friend of mine, Louis, we call him Wiggy. He got 3 years mandatory because when they raided his house, he got caught with a gun. So there was no way out of that without him cooperating. Another guy got like house arrest. Another guy got 6 months. So, other guys got probation and, you know, so what I'm saying is it was like there was no risk getting involved in that. But when you murder, getting back to the murder, when you murder, not only does that change everything, but it just changes your whole life. Now you go from being where the cops know who you are. They don't really give a shit. They got a job. They, you know, they come at you, but they could give two shits less, you know, coming at you with this. But when you murder, now they have bosses that are on their asses to come at you hard, to get you off the streets. Once they know that you are involved in a murder, you don't stand a chance. You get, especially guys like us, we're involved with several murders and shootings, and it was like you don't stand a chance, because now you get, it's called 24/7 surveillance. Wherever I went, they had wiretaps, strip clubs, nightclubs, restaurants, cigar shops, pizza shops, houses, vehicles, phones, anywhere you go. Anybody gets arrested, the first thing they say to get out of jail free is, do you know anything about me and my crew? Drug dealer gets arrested 50 miles away. Do you know anything about Erlot and his crew? So then on top of that, you know, when you're going, guys like us, we go to jail, that's not a problem. You know, I did 13 years of my life in prison. Going to jail for a couple of years is not, you know, if I was making the money that I was making, I would do that all the time. But, and I would go to sleep at night very good. But when you know that you murdered now, you know that if you get arrested for that murder, it's over. You know, your life is over. You're going to jail for the rest of your life. So it changes your mindset of the streets and everything that comes with it. You're not as carefree, and you're not, you always got that in the back of your head that you murdered, and you can lose the rest of your life in prison if it comes out, and they can, you know, and not only that, they're coming at you all the time now hard. You know, they're not going to stop. You know, they might not get you for the murder, but they're just going to keep coming at you for these little, you know, like I said, those three cases. I picked up 03 and 05, two cases. Then I go to jail, I get indicted again in 07 while I'm in prison for an extortion case. They just keep hitting you with them. So once you murder, that changes everything. That's why I would say, you know, going back, I would never, because you can never stop murdering everybody. Someone's always going to be in that life, do something to you. You kill him because of this reason, but then this guy did that. So now you killed him for that. You have to kill him. And then there's always going to be other reasons, you know, and then somebody in your crew, somebody did something to them. So you're going to have to kill for them too. So the murders are never going to stop. So the best thing is not to start at all, is not to do them. I mean, and this is going to sound crazy, but I mean, you know, you could give the guy a beating with a club. I mean, it's still not a murder, you know, break his leg or whatever. If you're in that business, I would say not to do no violence at all. That's what, you know, my thing is. unless it's something personal with your family and, you know, something like that, and you feel like you need to do that. But that could be anybody. That you don't have to be a criminal. If somebody bothered your wife or kids or somebody close to you like that in a disrespectful, bad way, you're a man, you would handle it. You don't have to be a criminal to, you know, defend your family. So the murder changes everything, you know. It doesn't change you like the guys involved in that life. You know, it's not like if somebody did something to you and you're in that life, it's easy to kill them. You know, you just, you know, you're a violent guy to begin with, and somebody disrespected you, to kill them would be nothing. But that's not how that life works. You're killing people you grew up with because somebody gave you an order. You're killing people. You're killing people, but not really killing the people you want to kill. You know, and then don't forget, it's hard to get away with it, and it's hard to get them and, you know, to get away with that. So, you know, the murder changes everything. And if I would have went back, I would have never participated in anything, any violence, never mind the murders.
Awesome. I was just wondering, Anth, so you talked a little bit about prison there. I'm just curious, what was the hardest part about going to prison that you really didn't expect?
So the first year I did in prison was the best year I've had as a young kid. I mean, it was fun. We were young. We were ball busters. We were wild. We were running around the prison. And this was a state prison with serious state prisons with serious men in there. And guys that could never come home. My first cellmate, when I first got into Concord Prison, when I first went in there, my first cellie was a guy doing a natural life, could never get out. I went in there in 1990 of February, February 10th. My first cellie was this guy named Dana. He was a guy doing life, natural life sentence. I went back to that prison, a different prison in Massachusetts State Prison in 2005. I got sentenced. I finally went in, you know, when I got arrested with those kids. That guy Dana was still there. I was in the same prison with him and another lifers too. My friend Jimmy Rodwell from he was in there in 1990. He's been in since the late 70s on a murder case, doing a natural life sentence, can never get out. So, you know, you see guys, you know, like I went 15 years later and I'm seeing lifers that I seen 15 years prior. And, but it was great. You know, I was 22 years old and it was fun in there. I mean, you know, you're working out, we're having fun all day long. Anything you wanted back then too, you could get. I wasn't into drugs, taking drugs, but if you wanted to have a drink, you could get alcohol in there. There was guys, food. When I first went in there, Concord was like, it's actually the Supermax now in the Mass, but I mean, it's got a wall, like a 50-foot high wall. It's a real serious looking prison. And the inmates were running it. I got they told me to pack up. They put me in the most violent unit in there when I first went in. I got told to move. They moved me to East Up. The guy, Bobby Giadoni, comes up to me as an inmate. He says, "You Anthony, yeah, get your stuff. Come," boom. He tells me to move downstairs. I moved downstairs. It was all 90% was Italians and Irish, a lot of Irish organized crime in Massachusetts, good guys. And we all stuck together, and it was predominantly a lot of, you know, the organized crime criminals. There was a huge population of Irish and Italian organized crime criminals. And we had the whole tier. And the first time I got there, I went to the end tier, went in there. There was all Italian food, Chinese food. There was guys, you know, if you wanted a, you know, there was guys, you know, anything you wanted back then, it was even locally too, anything you wanted, it was, you could get it. It kind of got stricter later on, but still you could get things in later on as well. It was just, you know, they set up things a lot different now and it was a lot harder. So that was a lot of fun to me. And prison itself is fun. I always make it the best. When I'm doing my prison time, I always, you know, even this last 7.5 years, I did 8.5 year sentence. You know, you go in there, you can't get out. So you're going to, work out, number one. So you're going to take care of your body. You're going to eat good in there. Not the shit that they give you, but, you know, if you're getting the good stuff out of the kitchen. And you're going to read good books, not these dumb books. Like, you know, you want to read self-help books, philosophy, you know, even read, you know, all spiritual books, which is what I did, and get knowledgeable. So you got to make the time in there, which I did. And I did that all my time in there. I make it good. The hardest part going in there is when you have the kids and your family. So, you know, I was married. I was going in 2005. My daughters were just born. I had my son, my two daughters, and my little kids were my little Grace was just born, and my other daughter was, you know, like a year or so. I had one. She was just maybe in her, not even a year, and the other one was a year and a half. And so I had to go to prison. That's the hardest part of going. Anybody will tell you, you know, when you have a good family and you have kids, especially little girls for the man, that's the hardest part. That was the hardest part. That's where it really affected me, is, you know, being away from my family, my kids, you know, my family with my kids. That's the only part that's hard. The other part, you know, I was still making money while I was in there, still making, you know, while I was in prison in 05, I was making low end $100,000 a month, and my wife didn't have to work, and I had three kids, and, you know, my money was still coming in. So I didn't worry about any type of, the only thing that was, you know, was being away from my family, especially the kids.
Yeah. So I'm expecting soon. Sarah, my wife and I, Sarah, we're expecting soon. So, you know, we're already very excited. Yeah. So I could
congratulations.
Only imagine. Thank you. Thank you. We hear a lot of these guys, like different people's different perspectives about, you know, cooperating, quote unquote, snitching, quote unquote, ratting, all these different things. And different people have different, you know, rationales behind it. For example, if you listen to Sammy the Bull, he goes, well, you know, John Gotti was ratting on me. They were giving me up. So, you know, I've dedicated my life to them. So why would I, you know, not cooperate in that situation? What was really that feeling behind it for you? Because as you said, the hardest part is your family. So I'm sure that played a factor in your decision, and maybe you could share your perspective on that.
Yeah. I mean, Sammy's right. And a lot of people, when they say that, there's 100 reasons what you could say, about why you cooperate and go that route. You know, I'm sure Sammy didn't want to go that route. And every guy that goes that route doesn't want to go that route. We don't want to surrender and cooperate and make a deal with the government. Of course, you don't want to do that. And there's a lot of same thing like Sammy. Sammy said John turned on him. Same, every guy in that life, that, you know, that life, everybody does turn on you, you know, and, you know, you're going to have those guys that took your money on when you were in prison, or put you in a bad deal, or put you, like in my case, put me around a guy that was an informant, and he knew he was an informant, and pretty much led to this one particular guy led to all the trouble in my city. But I still don't blame him, because at the end, and I did try to, you know, I didn't try. I asked permission to kill the guy. And he was protected by the guy. But everyone has a reason, and like I said, there's so many of them. At the end, listen, you're going to jail the rest of your life, and you have a card to play, and you can get out of it. 99.9% of the people in the world, if they said, "Do you want to go live in a room the size of a bathroom with two beds in there and sleep with another guy the rest of your life, eat shit food, take orders from guards, never be way away from your family, and you're going to live there the rest of your life. And if that's what you want to do, then do it." You know, people say that it was a bad decision, especially guys that cooperated, then bring your decision back and say you lied or say something and go to prison the rest of your life. if that's what you feel. You know, in my case, I don't want to surrender to the government. But I was going to jail the rest of my life. It was a death penalty case, but, you know, it was a life imprisonment case. And they offered me a way out by making a deal with the government. Now, I never thought of going that route, but when it initially came to me, and I was, you know, and in my case, I knew when I got arrested, I knew I was going to get arrested a month before I got arrested. So if I was going to look to maneuver and make a deal with the government, I had a month to do it on the street. And that would have like really helped my position if I was looking to go that route. I wasn't. I hired an attorney out of New York, one of the best ones in New York City, John Mitchell. And I was going to fight the case. At that point, I find out that two guys that were involved in the murder are going to cooperate. Felix Tringhese, he was in my city. He was going to cooperate. So that puts three guys involved in the murder to testify, not only about the organized crime activities, but about the murder. And then when the lawyer from New York comes and sees me, John Mitchell, he tells me that the boss of the New York Genovese family in New York City is not in the system. He was doing, his name was already Arthur Nigro. He was doing 5 years. He was at Fort Dix. And anybody that's in the federal system, you could go on the BOP locator, find out where they are and where they're doing their time if you punch in their information. So he was winding down on a 5-year sentence. And when this indictment came out with us, so I was picked up. He was picked up. He was indicted a week before me. When the lawyer comes up and sees me, this is like, I was already in now a few weeks. He tells me that New York is worried sick, that the Genovese bosses are worried sick about this guy already not being in he wasn't in the system. Now, when that happens, when you're not in the system, they think that you're cooperating. You know, they pull you from the system and now you go to punch in the name and you can't find the name. And it worries a lot of guys that you did crimes with, especially murders, because how can you not be in the system? You were at Fort Dix. So when he came up and told me that, he said, well, if they're worried sick, what do you think I should be? Because he was first on the indictment and I was number two. So that means that bumps me up to number one if he's cooperating. And how could his lawyers not even know where he is? You know, and this is like weeks later. So I'm figuring now that, you know, we already got all these guys cooperating on the case. And I figure now the boss, and it's not unheard of for the boss to flip today. You know, there was other bosses in the Al Diarco, Joel Messino, other bosses, never mind underbosses, Phil Leonetti, Sammy the Bull, captains. You know, the mob, you get guys that flip like that and cooperate. So I figured, you know, it's not hard to believe that he did. That's when it came into my head that I'm going to go to jail the rest of my life. And that's when I first started thinking if I could cooperate with the government and make a deal. And it was going back and forth. And my biggest thing would be, well, there was three guys on the indictment with me besides the boss in New York. And the three guys were from my city. So I said, if I am going to go that route, I want to let them know that, you know, because one guy was a made guy. The other two were, they're Greek, but they were violent kids. They were my friends. But they could never get inducted into the mob, but they were still like made guys, the presence of them. So I wanted, and they were involved in murders with me, all three of them. So I wanted to give them and say, listen, I wanted to tell them, listen, the guy in New York, the boss, put us with this guy who was an informant. He knew the guy was an informant, but he still put us around him. That guy was wearing wires. He wore a wire on me. He wore a wire on other people. And he caused a lot of trouble in our city. So what I want to do is I want to make a deal. We'll cooperate, all of us. And, you know, we'll come back to our city, just like I did, come back. And but I wanted to let them know that that's what I wanted to do and I wanted them to do it with me. And things just didn't work out like that. And but so that was my mentality, was to for them three to cooperate with me And, you know, we come back and get involved into legitimate businesses and, so, you know, no more mob shit, no more killings and shootings. And we, you know, they had kids too. You know, at the end of the day, the main thing that you think about is, you know, I was married with kids. So what's more important to me is, you know, the mob more important at the end of the day and then my kids, if I had a chance to make a deal. Not everybody has that chance. You know, everybody thinks like, you know, the government would just come in and say, here, offer you a deal. You have to be worthy of something to get that deal. You know, they're just not going to let a guy out on the street with, you know, several murders and everything just like that, you know? So if you're lucky enough to get that offer and you don't take that offer and try to get back with what's the most important thing in your life is your family. You know, I was married with kids, three kids. And, you know, then you have all your finances out there. You have a life, or you go to jail the rest of your life and throw all that away. You'll never see none of that again. So that was my thinking. I just wanted my guys, the three guys in my area to do it with me. That's my thing on that.
So we want to get to, you know, what you're currently working on, what you're doing in just a minute. But I have to ask you, I've asked John this question, John Elite. I've asked Michael Francis this question, and I did mention his name and we kind of spoke briefly about something relating to him. But Sammy the Bull, was he the real deal? And that's how I asked the question to Michael. And I know it could have been, you know, before your time, but based on what you know, you were in that life, was he the real deal?
Well, I mean, I never met him personally. I actually had sit downs with the guy that was going to go kill him in Arizona. One of his main guys, Huck, Tommy Huck. I think his last name was Carbonaro or something like that. But I actually had sit downs with him in New York. I never met Sammy. Sammy definitely was the real deal. You know, Sammy was became underboss of one of the most powerful crime families when the mafia was the mafia. You just don't become that back then. Today, if you were an underboss today, it don't mean shit, you know? But back then, when the mafia was the mafia, and don't forget, he even grew up back when the mafia was the mafia back in the 50s and 60s and 70s when it was really the mafia, you know, all the way up throughout the 90s. So, yes, 100% he's the real deal. You can't be realer, you know. He participated in all the murders. He was a money guy. You know, he was a gangster and a racketeer. You know, those are hard to find, guys that can kill and also make money. To have both like that is not you know, that's not a rarity, especially in New York, but, you know, it's good to be able to do both. So, yeah, definitely he's a real deal.
Fair enough. Are you following the case of a gentleman named Andrew Tate by any chance? You know, took the internet by storm, became very viral.
Yeah, I love them. I love them kids.
Yeah. So what's your whole, first of all, what's your perspective on him? You just said you love him and I assume you're talking about his brother, Tristan, but what's your whole take also on this case that he's battling? There's so much allegations and news and like a lot of it they're claiming is completely false and fake and all that stuff. But yeah. You know, what's your take on it from what you know?
Well, first of all, I love the two brothers there. I think they're great. I have so much, you know, people should just, young kids should not listen to anything I said, anything, just follow their advice and look what they did. I mean, they were involved in, you know, you could call them mobsters too, but they're not. But, you know, the things that they got involved in, they made their first millions in the webcam business, which is kind of like pornography, sex, prostitution. It's legal. You know, it's girls are doing it all day long. They go on the webcam and they make money doing that. You know, and they whatever, some whatever. They can't have physical sex, but whatever they do on the camera stuff. And then they got involved in casinos. What do? We get involved in casinos, but we do it on the streets. They got involved in legitimate casinos in Romania. So they blew up, they made a lot of money. And they're not like these fake Hollywood people that are bought and owned by the elite. And they have a voice, and they're not bowing down to the powerful elites that control the world. They have a major influence. They don't like, you know, which, you know, a lot of people don't like a lot of things that are being taught to these young kids today. And so they have a loud voice. The powerful people with the control of the world don't like that. And they pretty much said what was going to happen. First, they're going to throw you off of the platforms, you know, ban you from all the social medias and, you know, to quiet your voice down so you can't be heard. But that didn't work for them because they had so many people putting their content out there besides that. So they were still getting a lot of attention. Then the second, they were going to get you for trumped up charges, fake charges, railroad you. And that's what's happening now. And they'll probably beat this case. And the third thing is they'll kill you. And they will kill you. I don't think they can kill them because it's so high profile. You know, it's just like, I don't want to get into politics, but I think they would have killed our last president of the United States if it wasn't so high profile. They will kill you. And that's why he keeps saying, I'm not going to commit suicide. You know, but, you know, he's got, you know, you got to watch out though. The planes, these plane accidents that supposedly happen, those aren't accidents, that they supposedly all go down in these planes. And I think he's great for the young kids. He's not what they say is all the things for the misogynistic part of it. He's not, you know, he's just thick, you know. What the only thing I disagree with him on, and it's not really a bad thing, it's not like, is, you know, with the woman thing, these women figured out, the women are like are gangsters today. You know, it used to be like, I was a gangster. I made a lot of money. I was a powerful man. I had a wife and I had girlfriends. And then I had other girls in over there. I had girls, 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 girls everywhere, right? Okay. So it's okay for me. And Andrew said he's got four wives, right? And they have girls all the time, right? And they're wide. And they're why? Because they're in that 1% with all that money. And with the way I was living back then, you could say I was in that 1%. You know, when you're making 50,000, 100,000, don't matter if you got $1 billion put away or you got, say, 3-4 million put away. If you're making that kind of money a week, you can live that same type of lifestyle as a billionaire can. There's nothing a billionaire can do. I mean, a billionaire can take a private jet to some island. Well, I can fly there first class. I don't own the jet, but I can still go to the same island. I can still eat at the same restaurants. I can still shut down a restaurant. I can still, you could do all the same things. I can get woman and this and that, and blah, blah, blah. The problem is I don't have a billion. I might have millions. So the woman today, they figured that stuff out. You know, back in the day, strippers were known as taboo. It was like drug addicts, prostitutes, and it's not like that no more. So these girls today, they got all these ways to make money. And, you know, they're just not, you know, being that's the simple girl that's a beautiful girl that gets a man and stays home. And he goes to work and can barely pay the bills. And she's got to sit home and take it. These girls today know how to hustle. You know, they have so many, they, you know, they go on these social medias. They get hundreds of thousands of followers, millions of followers. They get paid by advertisement. They go on OnlyFans. They go on webcams. They strip, you know, with no sex. You know, you want to touch a pretty girl, you know, I don't, you know, you're not touching those girls today. You're not having sex with them without coming up with a lot of money, these hot girls and these things. So they figured it out. So the one thing I disagree with him about that is, you know, the girls, they figured it out. If they're hot, these, you know, and they're doing that thing and they're making that kind of money, you know, they're like gangsters. But yeah, I agree with all with everything that they say. It's a shame what they're doing to them. I can't believe how they're just holding them and there's still no charges and it's all going to fall apart. And then they got to watch out after they beat this for their safety.
It's crazy, man. I was just wondering, Ant, just to switch gears real quick, what's your favorite mob movie?
I don't think I got like a favorite. The Godfather 1 and 2. You know, Goodfellas was good. The Donnie Brasco was good, you know. I don't have a favorite. Like that old movie I liked, Once Upon a Time in America. That was good. Pulp of Greenwich Village, Casino, you know, the typical ones. They're all good. I don't think I have a favorite that and I don't really watch any of them anymore. I haven't watched a mob movie, I think, in I don't know how long.
Fair enough. I think Goodfellas was definitely my top.
Yeah. So talk to us about some of these legitimate businesses. What are you doing now? And, you know, kind of the last message you want to leave our viewers with.
So I'm just doing a lot of the, you know, like this stuff right here with podcasts. I'm trying to get my, I have a podcast I started. It's called Money Mayhem and the Mafia. You know, you guys know this. There is a lot of work involved. And there's a lot of time. You know, it's not really, I can't say that because I'm not aggressive with it. That's the bottom line. So I have a podcast I'm doing. Eventually I'm going to start getting more aggressive with it and maybe putting out some content. I started doing it for the local Connecticut, Massachusetts, Western Mass, going into New York. They don't really get a lot of recognition when it came to the mob circles. I was trying to put some light onto that, and I still want to. So going forward, I'm going to do that. You know, it's just I'm just figuring out a better way of going about that. And then I'm I was trading a lot of cryptocurrency. I was doing well doing that. And the real estate. I really like the real estate. I did a few real estate deals, and I'm just looking for, you know, with this, you know, a few years ago, you guys are involved with this. Before COVID happened, you could have bought this real estate, you know, like say in a nice B-listed area, you know, for like 100,000 a unit, say a 16-unit building, you know, 90,000 a unit. With, you know, kind of almost like a turnkey type thing, really, you know, with a value add that would go with it. And today, the prices just went up so much, like the same places, it's like 140,000 a unit now. And that's when I was really involved with it back then. I wish I pulled the trigger back then on more properties than I did, because, you know, and I'm sure you guys know the same thing. It really went, even the houses. Houses, which I would never buy a single family house in for real estate unless I, you know, it was one of those, you know, the Burr strategy. It was one of those type things. Actually, we were doing Burr. You could have called the Burr back in the 90s. You know, it was the same thing, but it was a great name they gave it, though, you know. But, yeah, but the real estate is great. And any business opportunity, like I was close to, I had a few deals with restaurants and strip clubs that one is still in the works, the other one fell through, and any opportunity that that comes up, I'm you know ready to jump on it, you know, whether it's real estate, whether it's a bar restaurant. Anything at the end that makes money and it's an opportunity, that's what I'm in looking to do.
Amazing. Well, awesome. Yeah, you've been really generous with your time with us here today. And is there anything you want to leave our audience with and, you know, tell them where they can find you, where they could connect with you?
Yeah, they can find me on Instagram. My name, Anthony Arellata. Facebook, same thing. I have the YouTube channel, Money, Mayhem, and the Mafia. I put out 4 videos. I'm going to be putting out more. I'm just getting things situated better with that, like I said earlier. And no, I really enjoyed talking with you guys. You guys are a class act. I'm glad I did the show. And it was a pleasure meeting you guys. And yeah, going forward, anytime. Where are you guys out of? Ohio?
We're actually in the Great White North. We're in Canada. We're in Toronto.
Yeah, Toronto.
Oh, okay. Yeah, all right. So, like, if you're ever, if I'm ever coming up that way, or you guys are planning on a trip, you know, to the Northeast or New York or even Boston. Boston's nice. We'll get together, like you said. We'll have a nice live show with cigars and some, you guys, you know, I don't know if you drink, but scotch or bourbon or something. And
they call Danny
nice
Fish. They call Danny Fish next time.
That'd be great, man.
They call this guy Fish the way he drinks. But yeah. Absolutely. Yeah,
wait, real quick. What is your take with the taste? Are you kind of like in the same way I'm thinking with them?
Yeah, there's a few things that, like, for example, you know, he says things that quote unquote trigger people because he knows what he's doing to get the clicks and all that. You don't have to be too sharp to figure that out. But some things that he says, they're I don't agree with because they're wrong. Like, for example, he'll say, you know, in the Bible, they, you know, God wants you to have more than one wife, but actually it was a direct command from God, to the kings of Israel to say, don't take up more than one wife because, you know, that'll lead you astray and all these things. It was actually a law of God. So certain things he says to get the triggers going. And I understand that, but some things are that are wrong. Just, I think on his part, just don't need to be, said necessarily. But in terms of the case, yeah, from what we can see, there is no evidence against them, really. And even the people that they're calling on as witnesses are standing in front of the camera saying, we're not here to be witnesses. We didn't file this complaint or this charge, or, you know, it's all baloney. And yeah. So, yeah, it's sad. We hope it doesn't get to the case, you know, the point of where they die, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what it sounds like, too? It's like the bad thing is that they're holding them. That's the bad thing. I mean, why are they holding them? You know, if you're going to, what's the reason for holding them? But you know how when these guys are like running for presidents and or they come up and they, you know, it's the same thing with these YouTube wars and everything. You try to get dirt on the other side and you try to however you can do it. Like when they come up with allegations, like 25 girls come forward and say he sexually assaulted me 10 years ago, 8 years ago, 28 years ago, 30 years ago. You know, they did it to Trump and they did it to other people. And then it all comes down is they were bought and paid for it. Like it really never happened, you know? And that's what's kind of happening here. Like you've got a couple of girls that are disgruntled ex-employees or ex-lovers or something, and they get offered some money. A lot of them got offered money for this and refused it. So the ones that are getting something, maybe they got money or they have other motives.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, the Romanian system allows the judge to detain them for up to 6 months or something like that. And again, as you said, no charges have been filed and their lawyer has come out and said, hey, what's going on here? So
what doesn't make sense, man, is they're holding them, right, without any evidence. And they're kind of just trying to build a case, I feel, right, while they're inside. They're trying to build a case. But that doesn't really make sense, because why would you try to build the case against people that are inside? It's harder to do that because they're inside, right? They're not outside. They're not doing those activities. So it kind of makes me laugh just wondering, like, what is their end goal? What's their plan with these guys? What are they trying to make stick, right?
They want to ice them. They want to ice them because they're making a positive impact on the youth. A lot of the things that he says, I would say 90% of it is great. Like, lift weights, you know, you're feeling like crap, lift weights.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's
exactly,
that's the number one thing you said, like, in prison. Like, it's fantastic. Right.
I'm curious to see when they come out, what their attitude's going to be like, cause they're trying to break them. They're, you know, I heard he was offered $1 billion to keep quiet and stop doing what he's doing. And he refused it. And he seems, you know, they seem like those type of kids. They seem like, you know, they would do something like that. So, you know, I'm curious to see when they come out, what they're going to act like, if they, you know, if they broke them a little bit, or if they're going to be, you know, going the same way and this, you know, with everything and just go harder.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see. I think I heard Andrew say something about there's a very secretive person who from the U.S. came to visit them to potentially give them a deal or do something or offer them something. And I haven't heard from that, but like, I wouldn't be surprised. As you said, there's so much notoriety there that for something to go wrong at this point, you're going to have a lot of people probably on the streets, maybe rioting, maybe in upheaval, because there's too much coincidences going around. I mean, you look at a guy like Epstein, you know, suicide or whatever, yeah, and he was so connected. It's like, I don't think anyone buys that that's what it was, but you know, right? Like for it to happen to a guy like Tate, where everybody knows him and he's making such a positive impact. Yeah, I think it would cause a bit more problems for the powers that be.
And the problem also is there's two of them. Not easy to kill one. You know, there's not one they got to kill. They got to kill two.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why I'm saying watch out with these plane rides that they take. You know, like so many people that had enemies of the, let's say, the Clintons, you know, that get go down in plane crashes and things like that. And you know, they have to worry about that. But there's two of them, so it's not like there's they can get rid of one. And like you said, it's going to cause so much outrage. There'll be he's got a big following.
Yeah,
he really does.
Yeah, absolutely. Anthony, once again, thanks for coming on the show. Very generous with your time and class act. We were very grateful to have you here and grateful that you came on. And until next time, you guys, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure you guys like, share, subscribe, leave us a comment, and we'll see you soon. Thank you, Anthony.
Thanks for having me, guys. Have a good one.
Thanks, Anthony.